I met someone today. I was in the building at the base center. And you guys know how you mentioned that there's really 56.
65, yeah.
I ran into someone who was actually tries to give lectures to Christians to educate them, trying to bring them closer to Hashem, the oil of wine.
Very nice. Where was this at? What did you say?
At the community center. You know the basketball court?
No. Is it just right across the street over here?
No, it's the second right, and then your first left.
Oh, really? Very nice.
So it reminded me of
that. Oh, very good. Well, this international organization called B'nai Noach. A website, and they,
it's a Jewish organization.
Well, it's non-Jewish, you know, it's Goyim, who want to live up to what the Torah says Goyim should live up to.
But someone's got to teach them about the...
Right.
So they have teachers from Jews?
They have teachers, there are many books written on the subject. They have in the library, I think, is one or two.
They try and recruit other Goyim?
There was a famous case about 9 years ago, 10 years ago, where a church in Tennessee, I think, the pastor decided that Christianity is not true, Judaism is true, and they split the church half on with him, half them. They had a whole court case, who gets the building, take down the cross, and there was a convention, came here, and they met with the chief rabbis for several weeks to get, ask them their questions, to get some instruction.
This I thought was amazing. He was telling me about, he grew up in the Midwest. He knows something about their religion. He actually studied some of their writings. Right?
Uh-huh.
Said that there's one of Yeshua's disciples or whatever asked him a question. What's the most important thing that we should know? And you know what he said? Did you guys tell him? Said, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Rabbeinu Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad.
And if you'll ask any Christian who invented the idea of love, they'll say it's Christianity. Anyway, tonight I want to give you a kind of general introduction to the idea of being chosen. Now, I don't have to tell you, if you start talking about chosenness, you'll run into an immediate obstacle. The immediate obstacle is people will tell you everybody's equal. What do you mean chosen? Chosen certainly means that this group is different. It probably means better, which is the worst of all possible choices. And therefore, they don't even listen. I mean, once they hear the idea of chosenness, they realize that it's going to violate equality. Their minds go out to lunch. You know, they're just not prepared to listen. So I usually start with a review of equality. Let's look at equality for a few minutes and see what it really means, see how we are committed to it, if at all. I mean, secularly, just logically. And once we have a better picture of what equality is and what equality is not, and what we really want to preserve it, but we don't want to preserve. So then, we can talk about chosenness without any background prejudices. But when we talk about equality, there are really two different ideas, two different things a person could mean when he talks about equality. One could be called descriptive equality. It means people are equal. That's just a fact. And the other is what could be called normative equality, which means people should be treated the same. This doesn't say how they are. It talks about what we should do for people. The idea would be that people should be treated the same. Everybody should have the same rights, the same responsibilities, the same obligations, same freedoms. Everybody should be treated the same. These are two different ideas. I'm going to treat each one separately and see how they go. And I think that we're in for some surprises. So let's start with the easy one, descriptive equality. The principle would be, the idea would be, everybody is equal. Well, in some respects, that's pretty obvious. Everybody, I guess now, almost everybody is born. I guess one or two clones, I think, now. But they're born also, so it doesn't matter. Everybody's born, and everybody needs nutrition to live, and everybody can expect to die, and certain experiences cause everybody pain, like being stuck with a sharp pin, and give everybody pleasure, like vanilla ice cream and listening to Beethoven. Okay, my tastes have slipped in here. But there are certain things that surely bring everybody pleasure. Love, respect, pain would be being embarrassed in public. So it's clear that in some respects, we really are equal. It's just as clear that there are lots of respects in which we're not equal. Surely in physical respects, height, weight, strength, coordination, beauty. Certainly we're unequal in those respects. Intelligence. Different types of intelligence, different facets of intelligence. We're certainly unequal. Different aspects of character. Different character traits. Some people are just naturally lazy. And some people are so full of energy that they can't control themselves. They can't focus themselves. Some people are naturally competitive. And some people are naturally cooperative. So we're simply not equal in character. And certain aspects of pleasure and pain, and happiness and unhappiness, will divide us as well. Hot Yemenite food is something that I would much rather avoid if possible. Whereas the Yemenites love it. And for me, if I had to be stranded by myself for a month and I could take along four CDs, it would be the late Beethoven quartets. And I'm sure other people would make quite different choices that they would take along for their 4 hours of music that would keep them busy for a month. So, one thing's for sure, we are not all alike in every respect. That's for sure. Everybody knows this. No one thinks that everybody is equal to everybody else in all respects. Not even all interesting or important respects. There are interesting and important differences between people. So, if we have a philosophy that says that people are different, people are different in certain respects, no one should throw a brick at us on the grounds that they believe in equality and we don't allow any group to be different from any other group or any individual to be different from any other individual. That's ridiculous. Nobody holds such a position. And this is true for groups as well. There's such a thing as national character. If you're traveling and you have a good travel book, a good guidebook, it'll tell you about the mountains and the rivers and the valleys and the seashore and about the local foods and about the local customs. For example, if you go to France and you have learned some French, don't use it, because they don't like it. You're murdering their language, and they take it as an insult. That's not true of any other country of which I'm aware. You come here and try out your Hebrew, maybe people might lose patience, but they're not going to take it as an insult. The French have this thing about their language. In Britain, people are trained with exquisite care for other people. I don't know how deep it goes, but the training is there. You talk to a British operator and ask to get information, she never sounds hurried. She never cuts you off. Calmly, will give you all the information you need. I was lost in London once and asked somebody how to get someplace. He walked two blocks to show me. Now, I dressed Hasidic, and this person was clearly not Jewish. He wouldn't just tell me how to go. Some stranger needs help. So he walked with me two blocks to show me where to go. That won't happen in New York. If they talk to you at all, it'll be round the corner, say I left. Get out. Leave me alone. Now, don't get caught on the trap. But for every rule, there are exceptions. So what? So what if there are exceptions? In a country of 75 million people, and there are 400,000 exceptions, that leaves you 74,600,000 people who live according to the rule. And that makes it a very useful rule. Because it's much more likely you're going to meet someone who fits the rule than one of the exceptions. So in general, you have a kind of national character which separates groups from one another. So if we say that groups are different and individuals are different, no one should be upset. Unless, in some detail, we say that this group has this and this characteristic which other groups don't have, and the critic will say, no, I don't believe that in this particular detail the groups are divided that way. Then you might have a discussion. But just the mere fact that we assert there are differences should not cause anybody any upset, seeing that everybody agrees that individuals and groups are different from one another. That's descriptive equality. Now maybe that's pretty obvious. Let's move to normative equality. The idea that everybody should be treated the same. Everybody should have the same rights and the same responsibilities and the same obligations. Here, people will tell you, that is the essence of a democratic society. There's no nobility, there's no special classes. Everybody's treated the same. Well, let's see. When the United States had a draft, when you had to go to the army, the draft law read something like this. Every 18-year-old American citizen is subject to the draft except for females, college students, people with serious physical or mental or emotional disabilities, people, two of whose family members have died in foreign wars of the United States. There's a whole raft of exceptions. If you take all the exceptions together, only about 40% of the population is subject to the draft. The other 60% is exempt. Now, is that equal responsibilities? The draft means that you are put in the army and you could die for your country. And 60% are exempt. That doesn't sound like equal treatment to me. Let's take education. Equality in education. I suppose that would mean each student should have the same amount of money spent on his or her education. Of course, you can't be exact. You know, the northern climates need more heating in the winter. But within reason, you try to make it as equal as possible. Do we do that? No, we certainly do not. Because children with handicaps get a much larger slice of the pie. Blind children, deaf children, children with learning disabilities. That's not equal treatment. Certain children are getting a much bigger slice. Let's take the right to vote. Surely in a democratic society, the right to vote is bottom line. That's where democracy lives. Does everybody have an equal right to vote? Well, let's think. First of all, what about people under the age of 18? The laws control their whole lives, but they don't vote. Then you have resident aliens, people who live in the United States, that work in the United States, but they're not citizens. They can't vote. Then you have criminals. In certain states, certain types of crimes mean you lose your right to vote. Then you have residence requirements. A person lives in New Jersey and commutes to Manhattan and works in Manhattan. His whole livelihood, his ability to earn a living, depends upon what happens in Manhattan. But he has no input into the laws of Manhattan. Because he lives in New Jersey. Where you live determines where you vote. Not where you work and not where you have an interest. So, does everybody equally have a right to vote? Doesn't sound like it. The real picture is this. When you think about a right or a responsibility, you picture in your mind the people that it's appropriate to give that right to or to put that responsibility on. And that group might be the whole society, and it might not be the whole society. It all depends upon the particular right or particular responsibility that you're talking about. This is what I call the target group. The target group of the right or the responsibility. And it's an open question and an open discussion for each right and each responsibility what the target group should be. Equality is never relevant in any moral, social, or political discussion. If somebody uses the word equality, he's hiding behind a propaganda word that contributes nothing to the discussion. I've been saying this for many years, for 25 years or more. In 1983, a professor at the University of Michigan Law School named Peter Weston published an article in the Harvard Law Review called The Empty Idea of Equality. He argues this in very great detail, to my mind, with very sound logic, that the word equality plays no role in any social discussion, in any political discussion, in any legal discussion, and in any moral discussion. You could scratch it from the dictionary, everything could go through as before with only one change. It'll be clearer this time. Here, I'll give you an illustration. Up until 1920, women could not vote in the United States. That's when the amendment to the Constitution was passed, giving women the right to vote. For decades, women were campaigning for this right. And even some men joined their ranks to campaign. Now, what did they want? Did they want women's equality? Women should be equal to men? Were they campaigning, for example, that women should be drafted into the army? Not at all. Were they campaigning for unisex bathrooms? Not at all. Were they campaigning for universal voting? Let's say for 10-year-olds? Or for aliens? Or for criminals? Not at all. It had nothing to do with equality. The real issue was this. Voting certainly shouldn't be for everybody. But who should it be for? Age is important, residence is important, citizenship is important, sex is not important. Their argument was you got the wrong target group because you've eliminated women. That's a mistake. Not that the correct thing to do is get to everybody. Of course not. That's dumb. So it's not equality for women and not equality in voting, but change the target group of the right to vote to include women rather than excluding women. That was really the issue. Every issue of rights and responsibilities can be and should be put in those terms. Define the right, define the responsibility, and argue for which group you think it's relevant, or how the present group should be changed, case by case, without waving the false flag of equality. So, anyone who says all people should be treated equally
is just making a bald mistake. It's simply not true that everybody should be treated equal. What, should quadriplegics be drafted into the infantry? How dumb can you be? Obviously, you have different rules for different people in some cases. In other cases, you may not feel that way. The right to freedom of speech may indeed apply to the whole society, but you have to argue that. You can't take it for granted. And then you may want to exclude Nazis and other people. For example, liberal, radical left, feminists, many of them are systematically against free speech because they want to see pornography controlled and eliminated on the grounds that it presents a degrading picture of women and hurts their position in society. So even though they paint themselves as radical left, when the free speech hurts them, they don't want it. Shut it down. So it's really a matter of a case-by-case basis. And therefore, we have a philosophy that says that not all responsibilities and rights and obligations are distributed equally. That alone can't be a reason to reject the Torah. Just because it's not equal. Everybody agrees that some rights and some responsibilities should not be universally applied. Only, again, in theory, you could have an argument over detail. If we point out a particular right or a particular responsibility, and we say that that right and responsibility applies only to Jews, someone might object. No, it's not right that it should apply only to Jews or to all Jews. Then you could have a discussion about the particular case. But a blanket philosophical objection, you're making distinctions, we don't want to make any distinctions, is incompetent because everybody makes distinctions. Everybody thinks it's right to make distinctions. That's normative equality. Let me spend 120 seconds on the charge of racism. You know very well that when they talk about Zionism as racism, what they mean is Judaism. That's just a code word in polite society. Is Judaism racist? No. Proof. There are white Jews, and there are Oriental Jews, and there are black Jews. End of proof. A system can't be racist if people of all races can belong. Of course, the critic will say, oh, you Jews, you're always like that. You know, I said racist, and you took me to mean racist. You associated racist with racist. I don't know why you do that. You know, that's just your Jewish literalism, I guess. What I meant was, you know, you think of yourself as an in-group and somehow different from other people. I didn't mean racist when I said racist. Why would you think that? You know. But then we're back to equality, aren't we? Let me just spend 20 minutes on equality. I'm not going back over that again. One final footnote before I get on to the positive idea of chosenness. Yes, chosenness means we're different. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the ways in which we're different. And this difference is hereditary. You're born into it. Now, this will make some people nervous. You're telling me that there's a hereditary group that has special characteristics. And that, they'll say, really is vicious, because then you're setting up classes in society, and you can imagine how the whole thing will go on campus together with the Rotten Tomatoes in the name of free speech. But don't forget that anybody can join this group. The doors are open. So to claim that we are setting up a distinct class in society when the doors are open for anybody to join is a very peculiar claim. If anybody thinks that we do have something special, he can join. Nobody's excluded. It's only when you set up a class and give it some special characteristics and close the doors and say, these people have it because they're born into it and nobody else can have it, then I think you could have a legitimate complaint on the basis of equality. But when anybody who wants to could join, it seems to be very difficult. In fact, according to today's prejudices, playing to the outside now, The difference between a born Jew and a born non-Jew is that a born non-Jew has more choice. A born Jew is stuck. He's in, and there's nothing he can do to get out. A born non-Jew has a choice. He can remain a non-Jew if he wants, and he can become a Jew if he wants. It's not usually regarded as prejudice or victimizing someone to give him more choices. That's not usually regarded as injuring someone by giving him more choices. So I think if you put it that way, maybe some of the misguided criticism can be avoided. That's the philosophical background, boring as it is. Are you with me so far?
Yes. Right.
So they
joined born into it. No, they're not born, but they're Jews.
No, I'm
saying some people are born Jews. If they're born Jews, their mothers are Jewish, they're Jewish, and nothing they can do to get out of it.
No, you're saying we're different because we were born into it, it's our heritage. Was it they're coming from the non-Jewish parents?
So then they have a choice. They don't have to become Jewish. They have two options. They can stay non-Jewish or they can become Jewish. Right? So the difference between us and them is that we have no options and they have two. We have no options. We have one reality and they have two options. That's not usually regarded as hurting somebody by giving him more options.
Was the target group that you say that's the issue behind the equality?
Target group is the appropriate group to which the right or responsibility should be applied. Leave equality out. Forget equality. You have a particular right, a particular responsibility, the right to vote, the right to an education, the responsibility to serve in the army, pay taxes, and so forth and so on. The question will be, what group should we apply this right or responsibility to? Should everyone pay taxes? Everyone? Or only people who make a certain amount of money? That's a discussion about the right target group for taxes. Right? Should everyone vote? Should everyone over a certain age vote? In the original 913 colonies, some colonies said you had to own a certain amount of property to vote. Otherwise, you don't have an interest in what the laws will be. So your vote isn't serious. So there was a thought to restrict voting to people who had a certain amount of property. Later they said, no, that's not an appropriate way to do it. Leave the word equality out. Forget equality. Just ask, what is the right group of people to which this particular right or responsibility should be applied?
I have a question for someone who doesn't know any better and would answer what you just said about the choice that, well, a Jew also has a choice. He can be a Jew or he can become a non-Jew.
The answer is we're talking now about the Jewish religion, the Jewish philosophy, the Jewish picture of how the world works. And we're asking, how we should look at it. Is it prejudice? Is it not prejudice? Is it fair? Is it unfair? Right? So we're talking about our rules.
So we're looking through our glass.
We're talking about somebody from the outside who's going to look at our system and he's going to evaluate it. I'm thinking of an external critic who says, your system is unjust. It's unjust because it sets up differences. Right? So we're talking about how our system works. According to our system, if you're born Jewish, you have no choice. So you have no way to get out.
Yeah, I don't live in the point that the cry that Zionism or Judaism is racist is such a loud cry right here in London and in England around the world. So they would come to adopt racism or being a race as a wider definition. I think you're giving, rather than just being a genetic race, they also mean a race by way of tradition, by way of culture, and by way of
good. So that means what? That means that this group is different from other groups.
Yeah.
So then the complaint really is a complaint about equality. Well, you can use the word as you like, but then what's the claim going to be? You're saying this group is different from other people, right? So that and the what motivates that complaint is no groups are different. Everybody's equal, and everybody should be treated equally. So the complaint boils down to their demand for equality, and I spent 20 minutes on equality. So either it's biology or it's equality. Those are the only two complaints that I'm aware of. You can use the word racist as you like, but the guts, the logic of the complaint is either that you are prejudiced against biological groups, or you think you're special in some way. And if I do think I'm special in some way, so what? Their complaint will be, no, everybody's equal, nobody's special.
So, just as an example, can communism be racist?
Can it? Not according to its philosophy. It would be very difficult. How could it be racist? I mean, they wanted the working classes of the world to unite all over the world and to take over the governments. Well, that has nothing to do with what race you are.
They just
emphasize the not that was their it's prejudice. That, so what would what communism have to do with racism?
They have racist beliefs.
What?
A communist state, whether you want to call it communism or not, has racist beliefs. Quite happy to...
You mean, could a communist state also, independent of the communism, have racist beliefs? Of course. What's it got to do with communism? Right? Capitalist system could have racist beliefs, and the socialist system could have racist beliefs, and the anarchists could have racist beliefs. Nothing to do with the communism. Yeah.
A person might say, well, the average Jew that's living in my neighborhood, I have no problem with them, but my problem is really... truthfully, it's with Zionism because they're trying to take start the whole Palestinian-Israeli conflict. They're going and taking the land. See, the Jew over here is fine. He's only doing Judaism. I agree with Judaism, but it's really the conflict there.
100% right. But then the complaint's not racism. Complaint is you're stealing land, you're oppressing people, you're starving people, so that has nothing to do with racism. Yes. That's a different issue altogether.
So what are the
If, for example, the Jewish religion wouldn't allow converts who are black and wouldn't allow converts who are Oriental and would take in only Caucasians, then they would say it's a racist system because it disallows membership to people of different races. But that just isn't true. Okay, now let's go to a brief, positive description of what chosenness means. I'll have to start with one more critical footnote. In some places, you'll hear people say, chosenness means that we have been selected to do a certain job. The whole of the world is based on division of labor. Different groups do different jobs. In the contribution to world civilization, different nations, different ethnic groups have different strengths and make different contributions. And we are chosen to make a specific contribution. That's what chosenness means. That may be good for propaganda. May sell well in the New York Times. But it has neither logic nor history behind it. First of all, according to that logic, everyone's chosen. The Greeks are also chosen, the Italians are also chosen, and the British are also chosen. I don't know about the South Africans. So then, the idea of chosen people would apply equally to everybody. And that's certainly not a Jewish conception. And secondly, if you look in our sources, you'll see that chosenness carries with it an implication that we are different, not just that we have a different job to do. Indeed, if you have a different job to do, that ought to be a reflection of your being different. How do you choose what job someone should do? Usually on the basis of his talents, on the basis of his strengths and abilities. You don't give out jobs arbitrarily. You don't distribute jobs by lottery. That's a waste of talent. So if this one is chosen to be an airline pilot, and this was chosen to be an economist, and this was chosen to be a psychologist, that should represent real differences among them. So assuming that God did choose us for a particular task, particular job to be done, that ought to reflect the fact that we are best suited to perform that task. Otherwise, he should have gotten somebody else. God is not in the habit of shooting himself in the foot. So we'll have to face the idea that chosenness implies a real difference between the Jewish people and other groups. Now the question will be, what is that difference and how to describe it? Of course, in principle, all you have to do is read over the whole challenge and then say, oh, the Jewish people are special in that they have the best characteristics to satisfy that challenge. The only difficulty is it'll take you about three lifetimes to read over the whole challenge, because that's the whole Torah. And you're just not going to do it. We need something shorter, something quicker. Now, I think this could be done in 100 different ways. I happen to be trained in philosophy, so I'll do it philosophically. That will make it difficult and boring, but I can't help it. It's the only thing I can do. Now, other people could do it differently and maybe do as good or better job, but I'll show you how I do it. Some things in life are valuable. Valuable, good, important, worthwhile. There are different kinds of value. When we say something's good or something's valuable, there are different things we could mean. Here are two. When I say that this is good, I might mean that it's better than the alternative. I'm just comparing it with the alternative. Health is good. Why? Because it's better to be healthy than sick. Wealth, if you think it's good, would be good because it's better to be wealthy than poor. Education is good because it's better to be educated than ignorant. In these cases, when you say something's good, what you really mean is it's better than the alternative. So you're really making a comparative statement. You may not say the whole comparison out, but that's what you really mean. This is good because it's better than being the other way. So that's one kind of value. I call that comparative value. You can probably figure out why. Then there's another kind of value, which is non-comparative. When I say this is good, I mean it's good for itself. Good in and of itself, without comparing it to the alternative. Now, if you followed me up to here, at this point, you should be mystified. What do you mean? Good for itself, without comparing it to the alternative? How can I not compare it? You tell me you're healthy. I know right away that you're not sick. And I can see the sickness and the health, and I can see which is better. You say, no. Just think of health and forget about the fact that I'm not sick. How am I supposed to do that? Any person who knows what healthy means knows right away that you're not sick and can think that it's better. How could you talk about something being good for itself without making the comparison, but the comparison is really right there in front of your eyes? Now, this point I owe to Rabbi Nachum Lansky of Neir Israel in Baltimore. The point, the application, the whole philosophy behind it's all his. I've been saying it over in his name for 25 years. Well, let's imagine God deciding whether or not to create the universe. He's considering it. Reasons for, reasons against. And let's suppose he asks you your opinion. Don't ask me how you got there if you didn't create the universe yet. We'll leave that on the side. Okay? So he asks you. And you say to God, yes. Yes, I think you should create the universe. And God says, why? And you say, because when you create the universe, it will include X. And X is so important, is so good, that makes it worth it to create the universe. Now, when you say that, you're not just saying X is better than the alternative, because right now, you don't have X or the alternative. You don't have anything. You don't even have empty space, right? You just have nothing. So when you say X is good, you're not saying X is better than the alternative. You're saying that all by itself, it carries good. Here's a way to get at the intuition, to get at the feeling. When I say X is good, do I mean it's good because it's better than its alternative, or do I mean it's good for itself? Imagine saying to God, could you say to God, yeah, create the universe because there'll be Vic Tanny health clubs, and there'll be people with terrific heart-lung capacity, and there'll be people who can lift, 600 pounds. That would be pretty weak as a reason for creating the world. If the world's already here, and people are already in it, then it's important to be healthy. No question. Because being healthy is better than being ill. And since you're here already, and you've got to be one or the other, you're much better off being healthy. But if nobody's here, if there aren't any people, to create the universe so there'll be healthy people seems very thin. You can reverse it also. You're much too young to remember this, but in the early 60s there was a film, a book called On the Beach. This was a story of a nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia. We all lived in deadly fear that, you know, our lives are going to be very short and end in a very unpleasant way. And in the nuclear exchange, everybody in the two countries is killed out, and only Australia survives, and they're killed by the fallout. And in the end, everybody's dead. The last scene in the movie is a wind blowing a newspaper up an empty street. It was a very powerful statement, you know. This could be the end of the world. Well, okay, the end of the human world. They say that the cockroaches will do very well with the radiation. No one bothers them. Yeah, right. And the people saw it, and they went around moping and depressed. The few of us who were studying philosophy after a while asked, okay, it'll be the end. So what? Why is that so depressing? You know, what's so terrible about that? Now here you have the same thought. Imagine someone saying, what do you mean, the end? If the end of the world comes, there will be no more X. X will disappear. That's a tragedy. We're losing something so valuable, so precious, X. Of course, you're also going to lose the opposite of X, right? It's the end of everything. So when you say the end of the universe is a tragedy because we're going to lose X, you're not just saying X is better than its alternative. You're saying X is valuable for itself, not just better than its alternative. These are two ways to see this idea, from creation or from the end, to see what's valuable for itself. Now, you could put the Jewish challenge in one sentence like this. Our challenge is to live, to realize non-comparative values. The values that make the world worth existing. Non-comparative values. The things that are good, not just because they're better than their alternative, but they're good for themselves. That's what we're here for. That's what the Torah teaches us to do. And that is our special gift. Our special gift to be able to realize, to implement, to live non-comparative values in a way more powerfully than any other group. Although other groups do have this ability, but they don't have it to the same extent that we do. Of course, up until now, this has been very abstract. Okay, non-comparative values. What are they? What are the non-comparative values? It's not health. It's not wealth. Not even education. See, God created the universe because there'll be protoplasmic information storage systems. Information storage systems made of meat. Brains. That'd be a very weak reason to create the universe. If you're here already, information is very useful. So it's very important to have it, because it's better to be educated than to be ignorant. That's only because you're here already. There's no reason to put you here. So what is there that is of non-comparative value? Now, I will explain to you the Jewish picture on this subject. That's all I have time to do. I hope that'll be enough. We'll see what happens. From the Torah's point of view, what has non-comparative value is a certain moral, spiritual excellence. I say certain because not everything that everybody calls moral or everything that everybody calls spiritual is going to count. We have our own definitions of these terms, and I'm talking about those definitions only. Here are some examples of what I mean. Rav Moshe Feinstein's Echad Tzadik HaBracha was being driven to his yeshiva in New York one morning. When he arrived, someone was there to greet him and opened the passenger door. He got out of the car, and as he exited the car, the person holding the door pushed it shut on his hand. The door closed on his hand. So Rav Moshe turned around, opened the door, put his hand in his jacket, walked into the building, and then was given first aid. His hand was mangled. Someone asked him, Rav Moshe, the guy closed the door on your hand. Why didn't you cry out? And he said, I didn't want to embarrass the person who closed the door. Now let's think what that means. First of all, he felt the pain. We don't lie on beds of nails or walk on burning coals or to suffer pain so that we don't feel pain. He definitely felt the pain. Number two, it was totally unexpected. A totally unexpected, excruciating pain. But he was psychologically more identified with the possible embarrassment of the person closing the door than he was with his own pain. That is a moral spiritual excellence. Something dramatically outstanding. From the First World War period, there were two stories also with respect to pain that have come down to us. One was the Moses Rebbe of that time, who had to have his leg amputated. He had some disease, and there was no anesthesia. And during the amputation, he composed a 64-part musical composition, which Moses and Hasidim still know. Rav Dovid Amstutan had to have an abdominal operation, and he refused anesthesia on the grounds that he was working on a Talmudic problem and didn't want to be interrupted. Now, understand me. I'm not claiming anything supernatural here. We know that there are ways to focus on one aspect of your experience and block out other experiences, other stimuli. But here are people whose focus on spirituality was so great that they were able to achieve this. In the Holocaust, the sefer of tshuvas, of inquiries that were made of Rabbanim during the Holocaust, one father came to the Rav in the ghetto where they were having the transports to the death camps, and his son was on the list for the transport. And he said to the rabbi, I have money, I can bribe the guards, and I can get my son out. But I know that they go by numbers. And if there's a short one, they'll take somebody else. Do I have the right to bribe the guard and save my son? So the rabbi said, you're asking a life and death question. I have no books here to consult. I have no colleagues here to consult. I can't answer a question like that. And the father said, you have to answer. It's a decision that I have to make. I want to do what the Torah wants of me. I want to do what the Kodesh Baruch Hu wants of me. You have to answer the question. And the rabbi refused. He said, I can't answer you. I can't give you an answer. So the father said, if you don't give me an answer, it means, surely, it's not clear to you that I'm allowed to save my son. So I won't say that. Now that's awesome. That's awesome. This kind of moral spiritual excellence, the excellence of a person to be able to take a position of great self-sacrifice and of principle, this is what the Torah would tell us is of non-comparative values. You could say to God, listen, there'll be people like that in your universe. People are able to rise above themselves in that way. That makes it worth it to create the universe. And this is very important, not only there will be people, but every person at times in his life, is called upon to exhibit courage, strength, focus, purpose, and steps above his normal level. Steps above, makes a gesture, does something out of the ordinary. There'll be moments in the lives of everyone. Great people are just different because they're more consistent in this. And everybody has moments of life where he steps above. It's this kind of moral spiritual excellence that is of non-comparative value. For this we could say to God, listen, you'll have this in your universe, that makes it worthwhile to create. Every law of the Torah expresses this moral spiritual excellence. Every law of the Torah. Sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes it isn't obvious, but it's always there. For example, you lend someone money. And you know, if you lend somebody money, you can't collect interest. So you're really doing him a considerable favor. You could be using that money to make money. Now, he owes you the money. You're walking down the street. You see him walking down opposite you. You have to cross to the other side of the street because he might be embarrassed to meet you in public knowing that he owes you the money. Now, I think that's exquisite. After all, I'm the good guy. I lent him the money at no interest. But that's not enough. It's not enough to lend him the money. You have to worry about his feelings. So you have to walk to the other side of the street so as not to embarrass him. That clearly trains and develops the moral spiritual lessons. Whereas, sitting in the Beis Medrash with 1,500-year-old Jewish Iraqi books, the Babylonian Talmud, doesn't seem to have any moral spiritual dimension at all. It is studying this very difficult, intricate, logical stuff. Doesn't seem to. But when you learn the Dorim, you learn the Mishnah there, and you learn that the study of Torah maintains the existence of the universe. So that the coal miners in Shanghai and the farmers in Iowa and the scotch makers in Scotland, all of them exist because of the Torah that's learned by Jews. And were there to be one moment with no Torah being learned, the whole universe would cease to exist. All of a sudden, the learning of Torah has an effect on the whole world. And indeed, when you learn Torah, one of the things that you should have in mind is that I'm doing this in order to fulfill, in order to support the existence of the world, because that's what the Kadosh Baruch Hu wants. And then learning Torah becomes, in part, an expression of your concern and support for the world as a whole. Every mitzvah has the job of expressing more, this kind of moral spiritual excellence. That is what is special about the Torah's challenge, and that is what is special about the Jewish people. I have one more footnote, and then I'm going to quit and take questions for a while. Does this mean that we are superior to other groups, other people? Here's where, you know, everybody's going to get nervous. If you're chosen, that must mean you're better. And God forbid you shouldn't say that you're better. Even if it's true, you shouldn't say it, because it's a nasty thing to say. Okay, let's do the job, philosopher's job. What is meant by better? What is meant by better? Here are three options. Three options. Either you're better in your abilities, or you're better in your performance, or you're better in your merit. There are three possibilities for understanding better. There may be others, I'm not counting. But this will keep us busy for a little bit. Let's see. Does chosenness mean that we are better in any of these categories? Let's take performance. Does chosenness mean that we are better in serving God or doing things that are important than any other group? No connection whatsoever. You can be chosen, you can be a flock. Does it mean we have more merit than anybody else? Certainly not. If you're a flock, you're not going to have much merit. And indeed, there are verses which explicitly compare us to other peoples. and say, aren't you like these other peoples to me? They failed and I pushed them out of their land. If you fail, I'll push you out of your land also. What about abilities? Does chosenness say anything about superiority of abilities? Sure it does. Ha. Don't try to guess. Think! This is not university, this is yeshiva. You have to think. Sure it does. Didn't we say that if you're chosen for a job, then you must be better suited to that job than other groups, otherwise God would have chosen a different group? So obviously, the ability to perform this job, the ability to face this particular challenge, we must have more than other groups. Correct. So in that respect, chosenness does imply superiority. Superiority of ability to meet this particular challenge. But that's it. That's all. No other implications are there. Somebody's upset about that, let him be upset. That's the truth. But it's certainly not superiority of performance, and not superiority of merit. Neither of those follows from chosenness. And since we're talking about chosenness, that's all we need to do. Yeah.
So the convert, he starts out with regular abilities, and then he can take on more abilities.
Correct. The implication is that Jews have greater abilities. When he becomes a Jew, as you say, he gets those greater abilities. Quite right. That follows from what I said. Okay, yeah.
How is it that we were chosen? Didn't our son go like all the nations and ask them?
I left that out because of time. Okay, I'll tell you briefly. How did we get to be different? How did we get to have this special ability to respond to this challenge? Here, the answer is a combination of historical experience, which applies to every group, helps to mold every group, and where we started from. The patriarchs and matriarchs, those seven exalted people, each one brought into the world a certain characteristic. That fund of seven characteristics became the national inheritance of the whole Jewish people. The Jewish people embodied that fund of seven, with variations and support and applications. But that's the backbone of the Jewish people. So what you have is a group of people starting with a particular fund of characteristics and then undergoing certain historical circumstances, like growing and multiplying in the land of Israel for a short period of time, going down to Egypt as nobles, the very cream of the crop for decades, then sliding into slavery in Egypt, then undergoing the Exodus. All of this molded that original group of characteristics into what we call Jewish national characters. The two factors together that make us what we are.
Just to add to that question, so this question of what makes you think you're the chosen people, it most commonly comes from someone who has a lack of knowledge and is ignorant and doesn't believe in God. So they're going to say, you know, where's proof? You're saying that, you know, I heard some Jews say that the Torah was offered to all the nations. You know, I'm Chinese. I've never heard that my nation rejected this Torah. You know, that's what everyone would say. So they'll say, you Jews made it up.
So, look, there are really two different questions here. One question is, given your system, is it vicious? Is it prejudiced? Is it evil? Is it nasty? Is it injurious to other people? That's one question. That's the question I've been answering tonight. The other question is it true? You can have a very nice system, and it could be very just untrue, like communism, which is supposed to be, in a certain sense, a very nice system. It's just hopelessly out of touch with reality. Right, so there are really two separate questions. The person says that we just made it up. I invite him to read a number of works, including one of mine, and to investigate the evidence and see whether he can sustain that position. Right? The fact that he hasn't heard about it, I mean, since it happened 3,300 years ago, I would ask him, how many historical records do you have from 3,300 years ago? What sorts of events do they record? How complete are they? And then we'll discuss whether or not it would be reasonable to think that an offer which was rejected should be among the historical records that have survived 3,300 years. My guess is that it's totally unreasonable to think that. Remember, when it was offered, according to our tradition, it was offered by an individual who went to them and offered it to them. Not by a mass revelation. It was offered to us by Moses. Right? Just Moses came and said, listen, God has a Torah, would you like it or not? Right? So the offer to them was made by some individual whom they recognized as an authority. And you know, they said yes or no to him. That's all. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Are we superior as individuals or as a nation? Because individually, we're just like a kid born into a rich family. We had nothing to do with it. My mom's Jewish, so I'm Jewish.
The superiority really is on both levels. You can't have any superiority as a nation if the people are all identical. Right? You can't have a group superiority if the people are all the same as everybody else. Group superiority has to be built on differences among individuals. But the differences among individuals can be that they fit together better. And since they fit together, the superiority will only show in the group, won't show in the individual. But the individuals have to be different. They can't be all the same. Am I making myself clear? If I have 20 people who are really all the same, I divide into two groups of 10, it can't be that one group of 10 as a group is superior to the other group of 10. Because the superiority has to be based on differences, and the difference will have to be somewhere in the individuals. Right? But it could be that the kind of differences that you have are the differences that only show in the group. You could have basketball players, right? Each one is equal, but these fit together as a team better than those. Then these will win their games. Not because this one makes better baskets than that one, but they coordinate better with one another. Right? So it could be a difference that way. Yeah.
That's from the external perspective, but what about an internal perspective? What about Kohanim and and Israel, is there any connection to that?
How could that be? Think of the principle we've been using throughout the evening. That if God gives a special job to a group, it must be that that group is better suited for that job than others. Otherwise, he'll be shooting himself in the foot. So if he gives special obligations to Kohanim, it must be that he endows them with the capacity to deal with those obligations. And if other people don't have that job, they won't need that capacity. So they won't get that capacity. Okay? All right.